Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. The big news last weekend was the depraved opening ceremony of the Paris Summer Olympics. I mean, did we expect anything different? In 2022, at the Euro Commonwealth Games in the summer, the opening ceremony was full-on Baal worship, where hundreds of stage actors were bowing down to a 30-foot mechanical bull. This year, three drag queens carried the Olympic torch through France on its final journey. And it's really no surprise because the Olympic ceremony is based on a pagan ritual. Vestal virgins worshiping at the Temple of Hera. Here's an obscure text, Isaiah chapter 50, verse 10. Verse 10 describes righteous seekers of God. Who among you that fears the Lord, that obeys the voice of his servant, that walks in darkness and has no light, let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. But verse 11 describes unsaved idolaters. Behold, all you who kindle a fire, who encircle yourselves with firebrands, walk in the light of your fire, and among the brands you have set ablaze. This you will have from my hand, you will lie down in torment. Now, commentators are not sure which pagan practice the prophet Isaiah is referring to. But lighting bonfires and standing in a circle holding candles is, for some reason, pretty much universal in pagan worship. And the symbolism is not what the participants assume. The prophet Isaiah points out that fire will be their destiny. Now, the big controversy in the Olympic opening ceremony was the bizarre stage act where drag queens sat at a table mimicking Da Vinci's portrait of the Last Supper. At this, all of the media erupted that Christians were offended by the Olympics putting drag queens in the place of Christ and the disciples, because now a group is being offended. But I suspect that if it weren't for the Last Supper mockery, not a word would have been or could have been said against drag queens being in the show, because tolerance, acceptance, and moral diversity are considered the highest values today. So LGBTQ imagery must be accepted and even embraced. But regardless of the Last Supper scene, the entire Olympic opening ceremony was just as bad. Men exposing their genitals, men gyrating over children, simulating sex, stage actors wearing Baphomet pendants around their neck. And as a large stage prop, there was a large head of a golden bull. They love their golden calf. Online, you won't find much video of the ceremony because NBC has scrubbed the internet. Usually, YouTubers can post news video feeds because of the fair use doctrine, but NBC is not letting users show the footage. Now, of course, the Olympic Committee has defended the opening ceremony by claiming the goal of community tolerance was achieved. And this is their ideology, that LGBTQ sexual deviance needs to be included in society. That's their virtue of tolerance. And the point is that even LGBTQ are welcomed to Jesus' table, to Jesus' Last Supper. The art director of the event, Thomas Jolly, is a homosexual and avid LGBTQ supporter. His rationale for the event was, quote, "In France, we have the right to love each other." Notice it's all about human rights, not the moral law of God. And he said, further, I wanted to make a ceremony that repairs, reconciles, and reaffirms the values of our republic, liberty, equality, and fraternity, unquote. And that's the new basis for ethics. That's the spirit of the age, giving people freedom, accepting all deviants. And by the way, that's the platform Kamala Harris is running on. She's all about freedom. Now, on the NBC Today show, they characterize the situation this way, quote, "During a controversial tableau, drag queens and dancers lined a long table of an image that some thought resembled Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, the portrait of Jesus Christ and his 12 apostles. Following the scene, some called the imagery a mockery and an insult to Christian people. Meanwhile, others found the moment a celebration for LGBTQ plus community and inclusivity. So there you have it, two worldviews. The one that believes in the law of nature and nature's God, and the other, humanism and human moral autonomy. The artistic director is now claiming that the Last Supper was not his inspiration, but the Greek festival of Bacchanalia, a feast of immorality and drunkenness celebrating the god Dionysus. Many on the left took to social media to criticize the Christian community for being so naive, so suspicious, so judgmental. Let me read one post here, just to give you a sense of the argument. This is from someone called Lady Francis. Quote, "I'm about to step on some toes in regard to the opening ceremony at the Paris Olympics. The headless woman was Marie Antoinette. She ruled over France and was found guilty of treason, conspiracy, and stealing from the country. Sound familiar?" So notice there, Lady Francis is making a dig on Donald Trump. But she continues, "Also, it was not a Last Supper. It was a depiction of the ancient Greek Bacchanalia, because you know the Olympics are ancient Greek. Surprise. If you didn't know, Bacchanalia is an uncontrollable, promiscuous, extravagant, loud party. The party often spans several days, which honors the god of wine, Bacchus, the blue guy covered in grapevines. He is also known as Dionysus, the Greek god of fertility, later known as the god of wine and pleasure. And finally, it was not death on a pale horse. It was Sequana, the goddess of the Seine, without the river on which the boat procession took place. She was meant to be the representation of the Olympic spirit of Sequana. So if some of you weren't so busy trying to end the Department of Education, you might know this," unquote. And quite a few leftist evangelicals have made comments that they were embarrassed over the alleged Christian misrepresentation of the opening ceremony. Well, first of all, such an explanation of the imagery doesn't sanctify the ceremony. It only further shows that it is pagan immorality and hedonism. Second, the central figure at the table, an obese woman, is wearing a diadem on her head. And the actors around the table were positioned like the Da Vinci portrait. How naive do you think Christians are? Of course the art director had the Last Supper in mind, and of course he's going to lie about it. Doing parodies on the Last Supper so as to include the deviant and to include popular culture has been common practice for years. I mean, just go on the internet and you'll find hundreds of parodies of the Last Supper, with using, you know, Star Wars characters, using movie stars, using cartoons. It's a very common theme to mix the profane with the sacred. You know, like Ozzy Osbourne doing music videos in churches and wearing a large cross. It's really apologists for the ceremony who are culturally naive and who refuse to admit the ideology of their own people. In fact, I suspect they're trying to mock us by gaslighting us because they know perfectly well it was a depiction of the Last Supper. Now, most people don't realize that ancient idolatry came with sophisticated rationalizations. The Baal worshippers would freely admit that they were not worshiping a bull, but they were celebrating strength, fertility, labor. And aren't those things virtues? And shouldn't we be celebrating virtues? And all of the worship of the Greek gods in ancient Greece was a celebration of aspects of human life, things that are beautiful, things created by God. But that is the exact error of idolatry. Not the worship of a stone, but the celebration and the honoring of human experience above God. The sin of idolatry is much more subtle and deceiving than most people imagine. In Revelation chapter 13, the whole world will worship the beast, the global government of man. Don't imagine this means some sort of religious ceremony, though that may occur in some places. Worship simply means ascribing worth to something. And the whole world worshiping the beast simply means the world will be admiring and identifying with the ideology of the Antichrist agenda. And all the same kind of excuses we see used to justify the idolatry at the Olympics will be used to justify religious-like adoration of the beast in the Revelation. You know, these people who are Olympic ceremony apologists are like the people described in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Mr. and Mrs. Love the World. Oh, by the way, with all of the satanic symbolism and hedonism at the Olympics, an Olympic surfer from Brazil was banned from having a picture of the Rio de Janeiro statue of Jesus on his board. So notice what's acceptable, drag queens, and what's not acceptable, a picture of Jesus. And one more interesting comment, someone posted on social media that after seeing the Olympic opening ceremony, quote, I am seriously thinking about converting to Christianity. The lesson is the explosion of evil in the last days is really more proof that God's word is true and will awaken those whom God will save. So here's the Bible lesson for today. All of these events are signs that we are in the great apostasy prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The Olympic opening ceremony is not an outlying situation. Leaders in politics and business and academia are all embracing the new religion of LGBTQ and humanism. What's considered a virtue today is the affirmation of all human desires. The Christian belief in submitting to law of nature and nature's God is anathema. This is the Psalm chapter 2 prophecy, that the kings of the earth are going to take their stand, and the rulers are going to take counsel together against the Lord and against his Messiah, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. This is how our age will end before the coming of Christ. A great rebellion against God is going to break out. So for years, I have been pointing out that we may be experiencing the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 prophecy, which states that the day of the Lord will not come until the apostasy comes first. I've always tried to be careful in this because every time evil proliferates during the church age, it doesn't mean the prophesied great apostasy is upon us. So I've always tried to say, just consider that what we are experiencing may be the fulfillment of this prophecy. This may be the likely explanation for the dramatic social change we're seeing around us. This complete abandonment of Christian morality, justified in the name of freedom and in the name of affirming people. Well, we're soon going to know for sure if we are in the prophesied apostasy or if this is just another age of corruption. Now, the worldwide nature of it and the satanic nature of it leans me toward concluding that it's more likely than not that what we're experiencing is this great apostasy. But regardless, we do know that there is going to be a time when the Christian community is going to experience the apostasy and will have to identify this as one of the signs of the time and believe the prophecy. You know, a day is going to come when Christians will not question whether or not they're experiencing the great apostasy, but they'll be sure it's happening. I mean, the whole point of this prophecy in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is that this is what the church is to look for in order to identify the coming day of the Lord. Just like Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24, when you see these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. You know, in the church of Thessalonica, some of the Christians believe that the day of the Lord, the time of the great tribulation, had arrived. Rome was fighting Israel. The temple would soon be destroyed. Jerusalem would be burned to the ground. But Paul writes to the Thessalonians that they're not currently in the day of the Lord, because two signs must come first. There are two signs the church must look to, or look for, and identify as to know when the day of the Lord has come. 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no one in any way deceive you, for it, the day of the Lord, will not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. What comes first? Before the revealing of the Antichrist, the apostasy. So this is what I'd like to explain again. I've covered this text many times in past programs, but Philippians chapter 3, to write the same thing again is no trouble to me, and it's a safeguard for you. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is really the premier prophetic text to guide the church in the last days, to explain to the church what is happening around them, lest they become discouraged or confused. Now, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is a neglected prophecy in the church for a number of reasons. First, Christian leaders don't want to predict times and seasons, and rightly so. Second, Christian leaders are accustomed to explaining outbreaks of evil to common causes rather than to a dispensation of God removing his restraint. And third, many Christian leaders place the apostasy as something that happens after the rapture of the church. But nevertheless, here are 4 points about the apostasy prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Points from the text itself. Points that should shed some more light on the prophecy and help us better understand what's happening in the world. First, the apostasy is not strictly religious. When we hear the English word apostasy, it carries a religious connotation. An apostate is a religious heretic. So a common interpretation of this verse is that it refers to denominational religious departure from the faith, that this is a falling away from the faith within Christian religious institutions. And that is certainly happening in our day. And this word apostasy certainly includes religious apostasy, but the Greek word apostasia has nothing to do with religion. It simply means a rebellion. And it was used in the ancient Greek world to refer to rebellions against civil authority. The apostasy is describing a worldwide rebellion against God, not merely religious, not confined to religious circles or to the church. Like in Revelation chapter 20, when the nations of the earth come to surround and battle the camp of the saints. Or like in Genesis, the rebellion at the Tower of Babel. Now, apparently, Paul, in making reference to the apostasy, understood that the early Christians knew about and assumed that there would be a great worldwide rebellion against God at the end of the church age. But Bible students will say, well, hasn't the world always been in rebellion to God? So this must be describing an apostasy in Christendom of those previously obedient to God. Well, historically, the world has not always been in complete rebellion to God. The nations have generally abided by the law of nature and nature's God, following and enforcing Genesis laws concerning marriage and gender, and the division of the nations. What's being described in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is a world going into a stage of complete rebellion against God, where all the moral laws of God are abandoned, and the world adopts a new satanic ideology, such as God's moral law is oppression. an ideology where man considers himself God, agreeing with Satan's original claim against God. And this brings me to my second point about the apostasy. What's the essence of it? What truth is being rejected? What lie is being embraced? And given what we read in the Revelation, the rebellion is against the authority of God himself. Man, like Satan, declaring independence from God. And that rebellion becomes considered an ultimate virtue, moral freedom. The messianic prophecy of Psalm chapter 2 explained that the kings of the earth conspire to throw off the rule of God. And of course, they have an ideological justification for this. So Christians should really discern the rhetoric that's pushing this ideology in the use of words such as freedom and democracy. You know, politicians are not using those words in the traditional sense that we should have freedom from evil, tyrannical government. But freedom today means freedom to have moral autonomy, freedom to have an abortion, freedom to practice LGBTQ, freedom to do drag queen story hours in public schools. So given the way the terms are now being defined, Christians are opposed to freedom, to equality, to diversity, to tolerance, to affirming, because now it's all about the approval of evil. So point number one, the apostasy is worldwide. It's not just religious. Point number two, the apostasy is all about human autonomy from God. Point number three, it's most likely that the apostasy does not begin on day one of the day of the Lord, the Great Tribulation. It precedes the day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord, the revelation, cannot take place until the great apostasy occurs. Because it's the apostasy that creates the ideological foundation to ready the world to embrace the satanic Antichrist agenda, which then ushers in the judgments of the apocalypse. So it's reasonable to assume that the apostasy that must come first will occur gradually over a generation before the day of the Lord. There's no indication in this text that the apostasy is to be viewed as God flipping a switch so that overnight a rebellion against God grows up. The usual way apostasies happen in Scripture is over a number of years. Satan has to work through natural means over time, raising up false teachers, the writing of philosophical books, takes time to influence the media, to take over the institutions of higher education. It took 250 years for Christianity to take down the paganism of Rome, and the satanic reversal may take a century. So let me suggest that the apostasy could have begun at the beginning of the 20th century. The 20th century being the age of secularism. And it's taken three generations to erode and erase the power of Christian culture. So, bottom line, if we interpret the apostasy as something that takes place on day one of the Great Tribulation, we will miss the point of the prophecy. The apostasy must come first, before the man of sin is revealed. Point number four. The coming of the apostasy is explained later in chapter 2 as coming by the removal of God's restraint. 2 Thessalonians 2:7, he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. God no longer does the work of restraining. The church is to know that there will be a period of time at the end of the church age where God will no longer restrain the sin of the unsaved, as he usually does, but will allow the unsaved to follow their natural proclivities. And this is reminding us that throughout the church age, God has been restraining sin. Otherwise, the world would have gone into the apocalypse in the first century. The point is that at the end of this age, before the coming of Christ, God is going to withhold his reestablishment of authority, as he has often done year after year throughout human history. Acts chapter 12, Herod puts James to death, and Herod glorifies himself, and the angel of the Lord strikes Herod, and he dies. King Nebuchadnezzar boasts, and God strikes him with mental illness. Abimelech takes Sarah from Abraham, and God comes to Abimelech and says, "You're a dead man." God allowed the evil Pharaoh of Exodus to be raised to power, but soon took him down when he got in the way of God's program. In Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 32, God pronounced that the false prophet Shemaiah would die because he preached rebellion against the Lord. The Greek word in the Septuagint there is apostasia. He preached apostasia against the Lord. At any given time, God can take out the designers of the Olympic opening ceremony. God could have kept these men from ever coming to the position of influence in the first place, as God likely did in other centuries. But in the days of the final apostasy, God is and God will step back from his usual restraint in the world in order to allow sin that normally resides in the human heart to come to the surface. And this is the biblical explanation for why the great apostasy occurs and how it's allowed to occur. It's not because mankind has all of a sudden become more evil intrinsically. It's not because humanity was intrinsically more righteous in the past. It's because God removes his restraint in order to expose sin before he judges it. The social goodness of the unsaved is not their own. It's been by God's hand of restraint. Now, this advent, this dispensation of God called the apostasy, is going to require great faith on the part of God's people. Faith to believe in the prophecy itself, that this is God's plan, and faith to believe that God is, and that judgment will come despite the silence or the apparent silence of God. When evil proliferates and is left untouched, people begin to doubt the very existence of God, and the world begins to boast. There is no God, or God's not serious about his law. Look at what we can get away with. But Christians need to hold on to the prophecy and the prophetic explanation what the silence of God means, that judgment day is right around the corner. As it was in the days of Noah, so it shall be in the coming of the Son of Man. You know, a few weeks ago, the Christian country singer John Rich came out with a song entitled Revelation. And Rich, in an interview with Tucker Carlson, explained how God gave him the song. He also shared with Tucker Carlson 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and how a great evil will break out in the world before the end. Rich then went on to explain his own post-tribulation rapture views and how the 19th century theologian John Darby twisted the word by coming up with his pre-tribulation rapture of the church, a doctrine that spread into American evangelical churches. John Rich really didn't do a very good job in explaining the situation to Tucker Carlson. You know, Rich made it seem like the pre-tribulation rapture theory will seriously shake the faith of the church when the church enters the Great Tribulation. However, I believe Christians are quite resilient, and their faith will not be shaken but strengthened if they see the rise of the global Antichrist, if they see the apostasy. And we really don't know exactly when the church will be taken off the earth in regard to the chronology of the revelation. I suspect some Christians will be surprised when they experience more persecution than their eschatological charts allow for. But Christians will adapt and they'll do just fine. John Rich's song is solid and it's having a good gospel impact. As Rich mentions in the interview, Eminem's latest songs are entitled Lucifer, Antichrist, Evil. And those songs are selling in the millions. That's a broad way that leads to destruction. Rich's song is the alternative, the voice of one who is on the narrow way that leads to life. The song begins, "Dancing in the flames, the people cursed his name." And that's a reference to all of the satanic imagery in popular music videos today. bowed at the altar of the father of lies. But there is a number to their days and to all of their evil ways. The Lord is going to turn away from all of their cries. So, since John Rich would like to get the message of the song out to the public, on this we will close.
The people cursed his name, bowed at the altar of the father of lies. But there's a number to their days and all their evil ways. The Lord's gonna turn away from all their cries. Oh, revelation, I can feel it coming like the dark train running. Coming back again. Brimstone upon their heads, millstones around their necks. They'll feel shaken when the trumpet sounds. And no matter where they hide, there'll be nowhere to run when Jesus puts his mighty foot on the ground. Like a dark train running. Oh, get ready, 'cause the King is coming. The King is coming back again. To the evil ones and all the wickedness they've done. There'll be no time to turn around as the stars begin to hit the ground and the mountains fall and the veil is torn with the sound of that seventh horn.
Oh, revelation, I can feel it coming like a dark train running. King is coming, and it won't be long.